That's kind of the big question, I think, is whether those bacteria and viruses survive intact.
Can diseases from long-dead animals emerge from melting permafrost? From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Fairbanks is worst in the nation for fine particulate pollution.
Good news, we have better data, we have more accurate information. Bad news is it's been worse than we realized.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Native Village Corporation Association's 10th Annual Conference and Board Meeting is May 10th and 11th in Anchorage at the Egan Center. Learn about new developments and opportunities from Alaska's business leaders, network with Alaska Native Corporation executives, and hear from the nation's top figures in Native contracting and small business. Agenda and registration at anvca.biz. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association.
A bill that would use bonds to pay off the state's debt to oil and gas companies for tax credits has raised a question from lawmakers. Are the companies interested? Revenue Commissioner Sheldon Fisher provided an answer today, saying most of the companies are on board with the idea.
So far, no one has informed us that they do not intend to participate. They've either informed us that they want to participate, which is far and away the majority. There's a handful of companies that have said they're still thinking about it and want to get back to us.
Fisher spoke to the House Finance Committee. The state owes the companies more than $800 million in tax credits. The bond bill would allow it to pay them off quickly. The state would receive a discount of roughly 10 cents on the dollar to cover the cost of issuing the bonds. One company that is especially interested is Kalis Energy. It has $180 million in tax credits owed it. Kalis Vice President Pat Foley says it would be a win for the state and investors if the bill passes.
We do have loans against a substantial portion of that. We'd be in a position to pay off those loans. And most importantly, we'd be in a position to attract additional investment to allow us to go forward at full speed with Nuna and hopefully to drill an additional appraisal well out in Smith Bay.
Lawyers for the state have different opinions about whether the bill would withstand a legal challenge. The Department of Law says the bill is constitutional, but an attorney who advises the legislature has questioned its constitutionality. That's because the Constitution limits how the state can issue bonds. The State Finance Committee will hear public testimony on the bill tomorrow. Air Force officials will host an open house meeting tonight to talk about proposals to provide drinking water to Moose Creek residents whose well water has been made unpotable due to groundwater contamination. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
During Monday's meeting at the Moose Creek Fire Station, officials with the Air Force Civil Engineers Center will unveil a plan to build a water pipeline from the North Pole Water Treatment Plant to Moose Creek. But Eielson Air Force Base Lieutenant Kit Sana Duanlum Chan says the officials also will talk about alternative proposals at the meeting.
The Air Force Civil Engineers Center has determined that this first alternative is the best alternative. However, the point of having this open house town hall is to allow Moose Creek residents to make their public comments on it.
Duanlum Chan says engineering personnel believe building a 5-mile pipeline from North Pole to Moose Creek is the best of 7 alternatives they've developed to provide potable water to the community. The area's groundwater has been contaminated with 2 types of perfluorinated compounds that came mainly from a type of firefighting foam used at Eielson in years past. But Duanlum Chan says if residents think one of the other alternatives would work better, they can comment on that at the meeting.
And based off in those comments, the Air Force might decide to alter or change its decision if it's like, you know, yeah, we see where you're coming from there, and, you know, it makes sense to move to one of these other alternatives.
The other alternatives include piping water from Eielson's water treatment plant and installing tanks and delivering water to each home or business in the community. The preferred plan to build a pipeline from North Pole is estimated to cost just over $25 million. Duanlum Chan says if that's the alternative the public and the agency agree on, and the decision is made final this summer and funding appropriated this year, water could be flowing within 5 years.
We would expect the project to be completed by around 2022 or early 2023.
Duan Lum Chan says more information about the interim proposed plan for long-term water supply for Moose Creek is available from the Eielson Public Affairs Office. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Fairbanks area has the worst fine particulate pollution in the United States, according to the American Lung Association. The national nonprofit released its annual State of the Air report last week, and Fairbanks tops the list for year-round fine particulate pollution. The community ranked 17th last year, and Rick Hinke with the American Lung Association in Fairbanks attributes the area's movement to the top of the list to more accurate air quality monitoring.
It's good news and bad news, kind of wrapped in the same coin, because good news, we have better data, we have more accurate information. Bad news is it's been worse than we realized.
The assessment is based on local air quality monitoring in the Fairbanks North Pole area for the years 2014 through 2016. Hinke says the three-year average, which reflects emissions from wintertime wood, coal, and oil burning, as well as wildfire smoke, moves the community ahead of large cities in California for year-round PM2.5 pollution. Fairbanks ranks fourth on the ALA's list in terms of short-term fine particulate pollution. For hundreds of years, animals and people have been buried in the frozen ground in the Arctic. Now that permafrost is thawing, and it's exposing those bodies and whatever killed them to the outside world. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more on the threat of zombies in the Arctic.
Can a zombie apocalypse happen in Alaska? Well, that depends on your definition of zombie, really. But can people and animals get sick from things long dead and forgotten? Yes. Michael Bruce is a public health physician and medical epidemiologist based out of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Anchorage. He told a crowd last week at the Beartooth Theater in Anchorage that infectious diseases are a growing threat throughout the Arctic.
I think Louis Pasteur was right when he said, it's the microbes that will have the last word. Or is it, it's the zombies that will have the last word?
But are we talking about real zombies here? Like shuffling around, eating brains, making zombie noises? Is Bruce saying that microbes are going to bring back the night of the living dead? Not exactly.
I think my analogy to zombies was more the ability of infectious diseases to come in and wreak havoc on populations and the planet. Not so much reviving dead bodies to come back to life.
But there are some very real threats locked up in all of that ice and frozen permafrost. In Russia, for example, an anthrax outbreak 2 years ago killed one 12-year-old boy and sickened dozens of other people. That outbreak has been linked to the region's reindeer herds and melting permafrost.
So really what happened is reindeer herders in the Yamal Peninsula were grazing their reindeer over reindeer that had died of anthrax decades or centuries ago, and they then contracted anthrax because of this and were exposed to it because it had melted out of the permafrost.
Bruce also says that anthrax is a very resistant organism. Once it gets into the environment, it can be hard to kill. Other types of infectious diseases might be more difficult to spread.
That's kind of the big question, I think, is whether those bacteria and viruses survive intact.
Research is showing that there are some that survive intact, but Bruce says most of them don't appear to be causing diseases in human beings. Still, a warming Arctic could cause Alaskans to be sickened in other ways. Bruce says there are more ticks coming into the state. The pests can hitch rides on pets or wild birds. He says the ticks do better in a warmer climate, and they may be able to migrate into the state, survive, and spread diseases. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, tourism is creating housing shortages for Homer residents.
I manage about 150 properties, and I think I have two available apartments right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
And by
Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a
24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com. Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
The Palmer Project, a potential hard rock underground mine, was the focus of a forum on water and mining attended by dozens of residents at the Alaska Native Brotherhood Hall in Haines on Wednesday. They were there largely because they hoped to learn more about how the project, still in the exploration phase, might affect water and salmon in the Chilkat and Klehini Rivers if it's developed. But as KHNS's Daisha Eaton reports, not all stakeholders believe the forum has the community's best interest in mind.
It was Mining 101 in Haines on Wednesday evening where the ANB hall was packed, with people eager to learn more about how the nearby mineral exploration operation, Palmer Project, could affect water and salmon.
And why do we, as a company, do water quality sampling? One, we have to do it for assisting the permitting process and compliance.
That's Liz Cornejo, Vice President of Community and External Affairs for Canadian company Constantine Metal Resources Limited. Cornejo is also co-chair of the recently formed Chilkat Valley Mining Forum Committee, the group that organized the event.
The Palmer Project is still in the exploration stage. We are getting more advanced and we're starting to do more in-depth studies. And we're hopefully in the next few years working toward feasibility and that information that will help answer that question of, is it going to be a mine?
The prospect was discovered in 1969 by local prospector Merrill Palmer, its namesake. Constantine is leasing the claim and partnering with a Japanese company called Dowa, which is supplying 49% of the exploration funds. That partnership has been going on for several years. Exploration shows the sites, located on steep mountainsides above a glacially fed river, are rich in copper, zinc, barite, gold, and silver. The economy of the region is largely reliant on fishing and tourism, and many are concerned that a large mine could interfere with the existing economies. Meredith Pokart, executive director of Tokchinuk Watershed Council, helped organize the event and was one of the guests at the forum. She talked about copper's effect on fish if too much gets into the water from mining.
Fish are much more sensitive than humans are to copper, and it impacts a lot of their homing migration, as well as their predator avoidance and their ability to navigate and find food.
Two local stakeholder groups decided not to participate in the forum. One was the Chilkat Indian Village of Klukwan.
We're a community that literally relies on the return of the salmon. All five species run through the Chilkat River. That's why our people, the Tlingits, survived and thrived over the past 1,000 or more years in this valley.
That's Tribal President Kimberly Strong, who says her community had participated in a forum held last fall, but decided against it this time around.
There was concern that if it's being chaired by the mining industry, we wanted our name off to make it clear that we were not part of the group at this point.
Cornejo with Constantine says co-chairing the 10-member group that organized the forum is a lot of work, but she'd be happy to step aside if someone thinks her interest in the mining company is problematic and if someone else is elected to the position by other members of the group.
And the chair doesn't really have a larger say in anything. It's still one voice in the 10-group committee. We just do a lot of the administrative work in the background to help facilitate the committee work.
But for now, Cornejo says they'd like feedback about the most recent forum so they can plan future events. In Haines, I'm Daisha Eaton.
An Alaska Range glacier melted faster last century than it did in the previous 300 years. That's the finding of a study that analyzed ice cores drilled on Mount Hunter. Lead author, Dartmouth College Research Assistant Dominic Winsky, says the glacial ice cores provide a unique high-altitude temperature record for the North Pacific region.
So this sort of provides the first window on what's going on in the upper atmosphere over Alaska, and it's even more rapidly changing than what's going on down in the lowlands.
Winsky says Hunter provides an ideal location to gauge the effect of climate change at high altitude.
Any sort of winds and precipitation that come off the Pacific wind up being deposited sort of in the front of the Alaska Range, right near where we set up on Mount Hunter. And more specifically, we needed a site that had the right topography and the right glaciology to be able to recover a nice ice core.
Each glacier exerts unique forces that compress ice, but Winsky says even before computing those effects, evidence of faster seasonal melting was apparent in the ice cores, telling a story of climate change.
Before the 20th century, these melt events were extremely rare, and sometimes you'd go for decades or more and it would never melt. And that was obvious initially when we were counting all of these layers. And then we spent the next few years making all of these corrections and really convincing ourselves that the trend that seemed so obvious was in fact a real trend.
Winsky says the increased melting corresponds with more frequent El Nino conditions in the equatorial Pacific. The ocean warming forces warm air into the upper atmosphere where it flows toward the poles, running into high peaks like Mount Hunter. In an effort to gain a longer-term perspective, Winsky says the research team hopes to analyze even further down the Mount Hunter ice cores.
This ice core that we drilled on Mount Hunter actually goes back at least 1,200 years, but potentially thousands more.
Winsky says if the team can interpret the ultra-compressed ice, it will provide better context to the last century's warming relative to a much longer time span. The information is published in the Journal of Geophysical Research, Atmospheres. Alaska State Troopers intercepted 56 grams of heroin in Togiak on Friday. According to law enforcement, the street value of that amount of heroin in Bristol Bay is at least $56,000. Troopers contacted 32-year-old Patrick I. Helling of Dillingham when he arrived at the Togiak Airport. Investigators revealed that he was carrying the heroin on his person. The investigation is ongoing. An arrest has not been made, but he is being charged with misconduct involving a controlled substance in the second degree, which is a felony.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Curious about your alcohol habits or those of someone you care about? Find a free and confidential alcohol screening at recoveralaska.org or call 211 today. This Alcohol Awareness Month, Recover Alaska reminds us that together we are stronger than alcohol addiction. Recover Alaska is a trusted source for alcohol research and resources, including an index of local available treatment options. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska.
Homer has a housing problem. Like many rural Alaskan communities, finding a place to live can be a challenge. But the growing tourism industry may be making it more difficult for year-round residents to find long-term housing. With just a handful of hotels in the town, visitors have been relying on Airbnb and other vacation rentals. As KBBI's Aaron Bolton reports, that demand may mean fewer rental options for Homer residents to choose from.
Kelly Parker moved into her house last fall with a six-month lease in the promise that she could sign on for a full year come the spring. Parker signed a lease at the beginning of April, but a couple days later, she was told her landlord had not signed the lease because he plans to list the house on Airbnb.
I signed the lease and handed it back to him, not thinking that I needed to have him sign his part right then. After so many confirmations over the winter by email and then a personal one-on-one confirmation, I just didn't see it as that important. I just took him at his word.
Gina Pelea at Bay Realty says she's been getting more calls every year from frantic renters like Parker.
I know sometimes when I first answer the phone, the first question is, this isn't a seasonal place, is it? We're not going to have to move out in May, are we?
She says more vacation rentals are making the long-term rental market incredibly competitive.
This time of the year, I'd say we're closer to a 1% vacancy rate, and more in the winter, we're looking at probably less than 5% vacancy rate. I manage about 150 properties, and I think I have two available apartments right now.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah.
More property owners are capitalizing on the demand for vacation rentals in the summer. According to data Airbnb shared with KBBI, the number of listings grew over 500% since 2014, with 160 hosts listing 250 properties. Almost all of those are either apartments or complete houses. And what seems to be driving the growth is profit.
On a monthly rental, the three properties, you bring in around 30,000. On a vacation rental, you can bring in 60,000.
And it is definitely worth the work.
Kit Barnett and his wife Phyllis started listing the upper and lower levels of their duplex on Airbnb and other sites 4 years ago after one of their long-term tenants moved out. After that filled up consistently, they converted their small house next door from a traditional rental to an Airbnb as well. Both are retired teachers, and they say they need the supplemental income. Barnett says she knows plenty of people are jumping into the market, but doesn't think it's anywhere near being saturated.
I haven't heard anybody complaining about their bookings. I don't know everybody, but nobody I know is complaining about it.
Barnett does think vacation rentals will eventually become less profitable as competition grows. But she says if that happens, she'll turn her properties back into long-term rentals, which would be welcome relief for renters on the housing hunt. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The Togiak herring fishery opened Sunday morning at 6 a.m. It was a windy start for the state's largest sack row herring fishery. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
A gale warning from NOAA was in effect Sunday as Togiak herring fishing got underway. The fleet faced winds over 30 miles per hour, and that posed a challenge for fishermen, said area management biologist Tim Sands.
The same fleet is over there, and it's pretty tough conditions because of weather. I know some fish is being taken, but I don't think a lot.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game surveyed the district Saturday and concluded that enough herring had arrived to meet the threshold for opening the fishery, 35,000 tons. The combined purse seine and gillnet quota for the Togiak District sack row fishery is about 24,000 tons, slightly larger than last year's quota. It's mostly seiners participating. ADF&G only expects one gillnet boat to be a part of the fishery this year. As for quality, when herring swim into the waters near Togiak, it can take some time for them to mature enough for their spawn to be marketable.
I've heard reports that it's mixed at this point. So some are mature, but not all of them. And that's typically what we see the first couple days of the fishery. There's not a whole lot of mature fish around. It just takes them a couple days to ripen up once they come into the shallow water.
Herring fishing in Togiak is open until further notice, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game will close fishing when the fleet takes close to the quota. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
The last person born in the traditional village of Kashiga has died. Eva Cherpanoff grew up in the small Unungan community on Unalaska Island. That changed during World War II when Kashiga was evacuated and never resettled. But as KUCB's Laura Craigle reports, Cherpanoff came through the upheaval to live a long life of 90 years.
I born in Kashiga. And I used to play around.
Eva Cherpanoff was in her late 70s when she sat down for this interview with historian Ray Hudson.
Eva, when were you born in Kashiga?
1928.
And who were your parents?
My mother was Sophie.
Sophie Berenin was an accomplished basket weaver from Chernovsky. Her father, Alec Kudrin, was a Kashiga hunter who died shortly before she was born.
We lived with my uncle. Nobody had no running water except us.
Cherpanoff's uncle fixed up the family home with a tin sink and a flush toilet, but they still lived pretty traditionally. The family spoke Unungan Ténu, they stored their fish in bags made from sea lion stomachs, and Cherpanoff's mom even sewed her a kamlaika from seal gut. She wore the waterproof parka while paddling around in skin boats, which were just being usurped by metal skiffs.
I used to ride in a badarkis.
Did you?
Yeah.
In
I tipped over one time.
Really?
In the lake. And I was just hollering, you know. Finally, somebody took a badarki down and picked me up.
Cherpanoff was the only kid in Kashiga, so she had the run of the place until 1942. That's when the Japanese attacked Dutch Harbor, some 30 miles across Unalaska Island. After the bombings, the American government evacuated Unungan people from the Aleutian and Pribilof region, including about 20 at Kashiga.
There was no time to take or anything.
Wow.
Because they can't wait for those planes come back.
Yeah.
And might bomb us,
yeah.
You know. Huh. That was terrible.
That was also the last time Cherpanoff saw her home. The Ununga spent the rest of the war in internment camps in southeast Alaska, and after the fighting was over, Kashiga was never resettled. Cherpanoff eventually moved to Unalaska in search of a new home. It was hard to do, but it helped that she brought her new husband with her.
Hi, this is Kay Defendall here for another segment of Eye on Alaska. And this week, we're here with John and Eva Chirapanov. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
In this interview, on their 50th wedding anniversary, Chirapanov explained how she met John at the Ward Lake internment camp. He was originally from Akatan.
You never knew each other, and then you met down in Southeast?
Yes, we did.
Ah, and fell in love immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we got married after.
Okay.
Then I had my kids same month, my oldest daughter. Fast work.
Yeah.
The Chirapanovs had 10 children during their time together, and Eva joked that she loved her husband so much, she married him 3 times. Once before a judge, again before a priest, and finally at a vow renewal.
You've done a lot of things, though, in your life. You've seen a lot of changes out here, and so you're looking forward to another 50 years?
60 years?
Yeah. No way. Well, you'll definitely...
When her husband died in 2000, Chirapanov moved from their Unalaska home to the senior center. Her daughter, Julia Dushkin, says it was another difficult transition.
And then she missed my dad so much.
Dushkin says Chirapanov made a point of being out in the community, staying active, and spending time with her wide circle of friends.
She didn't care much to be home alone or anything like that. She wanted to be out with friends or, you know, go here and go there, get her nails done.
While life in modern-day Unalaska was different than Chirapanov's childhood in Kashiga, Dushkin says some of her favorite memories of her mother can help keep the old ways alive, at least a little bit.
I asked her to teach me how to braid seal gut with the meat and the fat or whatever in it. And she took yarn and she put it in my fingers and go like this, like that. And then just tangled up my fingers and I could always remember her telling me, go this way and that way.
Eva Chirapanov died in Anchorage on March 22nd. Only a few Kashiga born Anunga are still alive today. Their home community has been uninhabited for almost 76 years. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Dacia Eaton in Haines, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Aaron Bolton in Homer, and Laura Craigle in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Opioids are powerful prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication protects children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday, you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with Nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.